And welcome back to Coast with Professor Eric Kaspog as we talk about his work, When the Earth Had Two Moons. Fascinating. But this hour, we'll also take your phone calls. It's the interactive portion of the show. And welcome back to Coast, Eric Kaspog with us as we talk about his work, The Earth Had Two Moons. We'll take your calls as well. Where does geology fit into understanding the solar system, Eric?
Well, I mean, I think of geology as the first science, you know, going back to the people chipping at flint to make knives, you know, the understanding of how the land behaves, how rocks behave, you know, don't camp underneath a cliff, you know, where the rocks can fall on you, just these basic understandings of how the earth happens. I think it's really rooted in how we think about things. And so to land on another planet, you know, suddenly you see, to go back to Titan, when the Huygens lander landed on Titan, suddenly you see something that's very familiar to everybody. It's a riverbed. It's a streambed.
Mm-hmm.
Big boulders. Now, you kind of have to ignore the fact that these boulders are made of probably water ice, which is as hard as granite at those temperatures, and the streambed is probably flowing or has recently flowed with liquid methane and propane. And, you know, a lot of the material out there is like organic goo, and it's kind of a hazy sky. But still, geology is kind of what guides us to interpreting what that landscape's all about. We've seen it before. We can extrapolate and try to understand what it would be like. Because ultimately, I think what we want to know when we land on the surface of another planet is, you know, what would it be like to walk there? You know, that gets back to being a kid. I remember me and my brother, we used to pretend we were walking on a planet that had, 10 times the gravity of Earth. And we'd kind of crawl around on the floor, barely able to move. And then
like
we'd
you're stuck.
Then we'd pretend we were on the moon, and we'd take these huge leaps. And so I think geology is our connection to all these other planets.
In 1877, with a small telescope, Giovanni Schiaparelli noticed the network of dark areas on Mars, which people have called canals. They laughed at him, of course, and things like that. You know what? Isn't it conceivable that Mars might have had some flowing water back then?
You know, that's pretty much guaranteed to have been the case. There's so much evidence now that these channels flowed with liquid water. We don't know why or how,
or what happened to them.
Or what happened to them? You know, this is all. You know, even after we've had four rovers now crawling around the surface of the planet, or about to send the fourth, we see evidence for early water everywhere on Mars. You know, you get into the middle of some of these craters, and you start to see these features that are formed by fissures that have been percolating with water, leaving behind carbonates and other kind of minerals, kind of like what you see around caves on the Earth. Mars was flowing with water. We don't know whether it was episodic, catastrophic. One of the big questions is, you know, did it ever rain on Mars?
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever sort of Earth-like conditions? I actually think Mars is a little bit of a harsh place because it's got one-third the gravity of Earth. So it's just harder to hold on to all that, all the water. You know, it's losing its atmosphere every day, and it gets stuff stripped away from it because it's not big enough. So you got to have a planet that's kind of big enough to hold on to its juices.
It's a remarkable planet, to be sure. What do you think of the possibilities that when we send a man to Mars that we're going to get information we never even thought about?
That connects really deeply to geology, because robots can do a lot of things, but they're not geologists. You know, they can do exactly what you tell them to do. And there is a robot on Mars right now. It's called InSight, and it's a NASA lander with a couple of foreign contributed payloads. And they're trying for the life of them to drill into the subsurface. That was one of the major goals of the mission, was to kind of do this self-ratcheting hammer that would kind of like pile driving a big stake into the ground for your garden or something. And it's got this little ratchet motor, And it turns out that it's just hard. They've encountered something that they weren't expecting, maybe rocks in the subsurface. A human could have figured it out in about a minute, right? They would have pulled the thing out, done a different hole. And that's why the astronauts were such brilliant heroes in the Apollo program, because they did all this stuff. They got in, you know, it didn't work. Let's try something different. But when we do have astronauts roaming around on Mars, you know, a lot of stuff that's overlooked by a very slow robotic mission, you know, we've got quite a brilliant little processing unit on top of our shoulders, and we're capable of picking out the important stuff, whereas a robot simply can't do that. And so I think that Mars has a lot of secrets that are waiting for us.
Whatever happened, Eric, to the Russians? I mean, they were ahead of us. We tied them. We passed them. And then they just faded away. And other than their rocketry to get people up to the International Space Station, they're not doing anything.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. You know, because following, yeah, they were the first to go around the back of the moon.
First to set up a satellite. I remember when they had Sputnik up there, we went crazy.
There was this little thing that went beep that was going over our heads, the size of a basketball, I guess. And that capability is, I think that's a big theme of space exploration in general, because you're using the same rockets that you launch ICBMs on. You're using the same design teams. You're using the same guidance computers. You're using the same system management. The same companies built the Apollo mission that built all of our defense rocketry. And so it's a proof that you can do it. And so when we beat the Russians to the moon, it was. About a year or two ahead of Apollo, it was pretty clear that we would be the first to have humans on the moon. And the Russians were trying to get there first to get the first samples back, because they had robotic landers that we didn't know how to make. And they could land robotically and have like a little rocket that would send it back to Earth. They were trying to upstage us one last time, but that didn't work out. They crashed that mission that would have sent back actually the first lunar samples. So in the end, we won. Russia kept going forward. I believe that the space race saved us from the Cold War. The fact that we had this venue, this playing field that we could play on that was very serious, you know, people could die. The stakes are very high. Who's going to be the dominant superpower for the next 50 years, you know, would be determined, I think, by who lands on the moon. Yet at the same time, it's a peaceful kind of an approach. When it came to landing on the moon, the Russians were going to try to do this sample return a few days before the Eagle landed. And in the end, they coordinated with the U.S. to make sure that none of the astronauts would get, there would be no interference between their mission and the U.S. mission. And so it led to the sense of cooperation, and you had the Apollo-Soyuz docking in space. That was the last Apollo mission, was this kind of handshake. And I find that absolutely remarkable, because 12 years before the Apollo-Soyuz mission, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And just a decade later, now you have this intimate connection of the space programs, because you don't dock two crewed vessels in orbit without sharing a whole lot of detailed information. And you can figure out their operation, you know, how they go about planning and how they go about communicating with their crews. And you get a lot of opportunities to get detailed intel. And so it was this sharing of techniques and capabilities. The Russians, they kept going. They tried to send a very ambitious mission to the Martian moons. Phobos is one of the mysterious moons of Mars. And they tried twice. Both of those failed. They tried a third time in 2018. That one failed. You know, their big heyday of success was definitely in the 1970s. For me, the pinnacle, the Russians are the only nation to have landed on Venus which is probably the hardest planet to land.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Nowadays, I think it's a lack of focus. It takes a huge amount of things going right in the right order to get an ambitious space program to work. It's not just about money, but it's really about having all the pipeline of all the expertise. And when you look at their mission failures, they were usually the cause of something not being under extremely tight quality control.
The late science fiction writer Jerry Pournelle once told me, Eric, that we had a plan to definitely get there first by sending a man to the moon. It was a one-way mission, and we were going to continue to send him food and launch stuff to him, but he wasn't coming back, and they had volunteers for it and everything else, and thank God we didn't have to go that route.
Well, I know probably 10 people I can just list who would volunteer to go to Mars on that under those terms.
Same premise, yeah. First-time caller Jim in Placerville, California. Hey, Jim, go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Hello, Professor Eric.
Hey, Jimmy.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sure can.
Yeah. Okay. What a fascinating conversation you guys are having. My question is a geology question, but just to say about the when you guys were talking about life out there,
mm-hmm.
it's a definite, and it's going to come in any sort of myriad forms. And the one I look to here on Earth is the octopus. I know you were talking about dolphins, but I think the octopus is probably the most intelligent life form we have on the planet, and some people think that's alien too.
Interesting.
Yeah, but my question...
It's the smartest of all the mollusks, right? The octopus.
The octopus, man. You bet. But my question is, there's a theory that our moon was created by a collision with a protoplanet. And so my theory is, I think we have a scar there, and I think it's Yellowstone Park. I think that's the biggest megavolcano we have, and I don't know if that would be the entry point or the exit point of when we got collided with. What do you think?
Interesting. What do you think about that, Eric? And the caldera in Yellowstone is a monster. It erupts every 600,000 years, and it's about 100,000 years overdue.
I could imagine that a collision could have something to do with Yellowstone. I think that generally speaking, the crust of the Earth is always overturning. Like when you think about how old is the Pacific Ocean or how old is the Atlantic Ocean? The plate tectonics on the Earth keeps changing it and changing it and changing it. About every 200 million years, the whole surface of the Earth, the ocean basins are all different. The Atlantic's opening up, the Pacific's closing, India crashed into the Himalayas. So Yellowstone, the odds of that being around, you know, way back when the moon formed is pretty close to zero. But the possibility that an impact had something to do with the caldera, that's an intriguing thought, because a large cratering event does leave kind of a thermal signature and stir stuff up.
Eric, how did we get so much water on this planet? My gosh!
Some people say we're lucky that we don't have more. If you go back to when I was saying we used to have 30 planets or 100 planets that all cannibalized each other, and you go through the math, you know, how much water do we expect there was when you grew and built the Earth? We should have oceans that are maybe three or four or five times deeper than they are, which, if you go in that direction, you might imagine a planet that's nothing but water.
What did you think of Velikovsky's theory of worlds in collision, that Venus was a captured comet?
You know, that can't work. It just violates physics, essentially. It's not to say we figured Venus out. We don't know. There are so many strange mysteries about Venus. And a part of Velikovsky's theory had to do with the fact that, you know, Venus and the Earth, they dance together. Venus goes around the sun, I think it's 11 times for every 8 times the Earth does. It's this, very close integer value. So if you plot Venus going around the sun and you plot the Earth going around the sun, and you plot them both at the same time, I have a figure of it in my book. It makes this spirograph that we call the Venus Rose. So there is some kind of connection to Venus and the Earth. But any of those kind of capture mechanisms would have had to happen in the early heyday when there was a lot more material moving around. nowadays, you just can't, you have to just violate physics to get it to end up in the right spot.
Let's go to Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, George. Hi, Eric. I love your program.
Well, thank you.
My question is, what if there were no other planets in the universe and no other objects, no moons, no suns? What effect would that have on Earth? Or in other words, what effect do all the objects in the universe have on Earth, like the magnetic field, like gravity, like light, like heat?
Well, let's take the solar system as the example, Eric. What if we were the only planet along with our sun in the solar system?
Yeah, let's see about that. Like, cause if you took the sun away, you'd have big problems, because then we'd be a big ice ball.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here.
So you got to have the sun. So just the sun and the Earth. You know, I think we'd just have this impoverished, astronomical existence. There wouldn't be a lot to look at in the sky, but as far as the day-to-day happenings, other than the fact that the moon, as we talked about in the last hour, kind of anchors the Earth and gives it stability of its seasons, other than that, we don't need these other planets. But I would say one thing to your question is Jupiter turns out to be quite important.
How come?
Well, it's like this barricade. When you think about all the comets that are out there beyond Jupiter, so things that could hit the Earth.
It's our blocker if it were a football game.
It's our blocker. It's our big blocker. It's really hard for comets to come into the inner solar system. They get shot out by Jupiter. It's like a goalie, like a blocker. And so the Earth actually gets protected quite a bit by Jupiter. And so if you didn't have and this gets get down to the question of, how unique is life? You might say, well, all we need is the Earth and the moon and the sun. But, maybe you need the Earth and the moon and the sun, and maybe you need comets that come and collide with the Earth early on, because they're loaded with all kinds of organics and all kinds of amino acids, actually. Comets are extremely complex with a lot of life's precursors are built into the geology of comets. And 70 amino acids have been identified inside of the tails of comets by astronomers. And so maybe you need these comets, and then you need Jupiter to shut down the process so you don't get any more of them. So it might be that you need to have all these ducks in a row.
Where do we get the book, When the Earth Had Two Moons?
Well, it's HarperCollins. And you
good
can
publisher.
Get it on the publisher's HarperCollins. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble. It came out today. It was the release day today.
Great timing.
Yeah, you should be starting to see it at the bookstores. And it's available in the hardcover version is really nice. And it has 65 pictures, because I realize it's kind of a complicated topic. I decided not to hold back on anything that we know about, because it's a beautiful story that can be told, I think, in relatively basic terms. But if you really want to know the details, you got to follow along a few threads of thought. And so I break it up with a lot of pictures. I try to make it so that you can jump into the book at different places.
Well, you did a great job with it, Eric, and you've cataloged everything perfectly. We're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our special guest, Eric Kespog, with us. His book, When the Earth Had Two Moons, just came out, as he just told you before the break. Eric, what other revelations in the universe would you love to find out about?
Gosh.
I ask these perplexing questions, don't I?
it's all revelatory. Every time we have space missions, we are astonished by we find something that we've never seen before. So I'm on the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is this asteroid mission that is going to land, not really land on the surface, because its one goal is to grab a sample and bring it back to Earth so we know what this asteroid is made of. And when we got there, it turned out to be completely different than we expected, which is a challenge for the engineers. The sampling is going to happen in August. They're going to touch down, find the rock on the surface that we can grab and bring back. But we were expecting a smooth area that we could land on because we'd seen that on other asteroids. So here we get to this asteroid, and it turns out to be nothing but rocks, big boulders, and it's kind of treacherous from an engineering point of view. So I think it's just a lesson that whenever you go anywhere, your mind gets blown, because we are not prepared to really understand the whole diversity of geology that's out there. I think that we should have many, 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 many more small space missions. We should be focusing on doing things a little bit higher risk, a little bit cheaper, maybe sending missions that cost $50 million or $100 million instead of putting a lot of money into the... I mean, you got to spend money on the big missions. But the main thing is to increase the scope of what we know is out there, because I think still we're kind of neophytes when it comes to understanding the solar system.
I think so, too. Are you glad you entered into this field?
Yeah. I mean, my dad said that I should be an astronomer when I was a little kid, and I think our job is to kind of do the opposite of what your dad tells you to do.
Yeah.
So when I went to college, I studied English and I studied math. I actually tried to study astrophysics, and I didn't know about planetary science. Astrophysics was sort of what you studied if you wanted to learn about the universe, and I found it to be kind of tedious, not because the subject is, but because it was very heavy on the physics, very heavy on some stuff that just wasn't that interesting to me. And it wasn't until after teaching high school for 3 years that I discovered planetary geology. I didn't even know it existed, really, and that it was something you could study and go to school to study. So then I ended up in a graduate program in planetary geology, and for me it changed everything, because it helped me understand where we are in the world, in the universe, what the rocks are underneath my feet. I think everybody needs to have a little bit of basics of geology just to kind of anchor yourself. You got 100 years or so to live on this planet, and it's a great advantage to sort of know what the planet's all about and how it works. I think it makes it so much more beautiful and makes it a lot more of an interesting journey.
Let's go to the final calls. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
All right, Joe.
Good. Eric, yeah, speaking of Venus...
Hey, Joe, you sound like you're in a muffle.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, geez, it's my phone. I'm sorry about that.
Uh-oh. Give him a real quick question. Go ahead.
Okay, yes, Eric. Speaking of Venus, what causes its ammonia atmosphere, and what dictates a planet's atmosphere anyway?
So the atmosphere of a planet is, you could think of it as everything that doesn't belong in the rocks. And so the moon has no atmosphere because it's too small to really hang on to anything. Mars is the next one up. Earth is the next one up. We have a one bar atmosphere. That's what you call the bars. It's the unit of pressure that we have on Earth. And then you get to Venus, and Venus has an atmospheric pressure that would crush you. If you were to stand on the surface of Venus, how would you die?
Mm-hmm.
You'd probably die first by being crushed to death rather than being roasted. But the atmosphere of Venus, it's mostly carbon dioxide. And somehow you have two planets that are really close to each other in mass. They're really close to each other in composition. They have about the same bulk density. Somehow the Earth managed to consume its carbon dioxide into the rocks. When you walk around and you look at limestone and you look at marble and you look at calcium carbonate deposits, this is the atmosphere of the Earth that once was, that's been buried into the crust of the Earth.
Well, we also had vegetation, Eric, that probably sucked it up.
Vegetation sucked a lot of it up, but most of it actually got subducted and plowed down under. It dissolves in the ocean water. It precipitates down onto the surface of the base of the ocean and then gets cycled down into the Earth by plate tectonics. And we think that the reason Venus is different from the Earth is that Venus never had the ocean which would dissolve the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and it never had the plate tectonics that would then bury it under there. Somehow, if you took all this carbonate materials on the Earth and you turned it back into carbon dioxide, you'd have kind of a Venus-like atmosphere on the Earth.
Let's go to Jeff in Sonora, California. Hey, Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. I know it's time short. At the outset of your guys' conversation, he was talking about, as you know, being a scientist, that he doesn't believe in alien life forms, et cetera, except for unicellular, that is. But honestly, Eric, with all due respect, you represent a dim view that discounts all the individuals that basically have had encounters, from the Hills to myself to Travis Walton. I mean, if you want, you can hook us all to a polygraph test, and when we pass, we'll show you. But just wanted to, you know, food for thought on that aspect. But my main question was, have you ever heard of the Dogon tribe legend that the Earth was literally pulled into the Earth's orbit?
That the moon was pulled into the Earth's orbit?
Yes.
I have not heard that.
The Dogon tribe was an interesting tribe that pinpointed the Sirius binary star system, Eric, before we even knew about it. And they talked about it. And how in the world would they find out? And they pointed up when somebody had asked them, how did you know about this? They pointed up like somebody had come down to tell them. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, I should say it's not that I don't believe, it's that I don't know. And those to me are two different things. I believe there's life out there, but I don't personally know it. And I haven't seen any concrete evidence for it. But again, like I said at the start, you know, someone has to hold the role of being the skeptic, because if nobody's skeptical, then you don't know if you know it. You sort of have to have this, and again, science is this very, it's a pursuit of knowledge that's very formal, and you go from point A to point B, and you don't accept something as truth, really, until all the evidence is there. Now, I should bring up the story of Giordano Bruno, who's one of my heroes. He was a monk and a philosopher back in the 1500s, and he was burned at the stake in 1600. He believed life was everywhere. He believed that the stars all had planets. He believed that the stars were all suns. And he had other heretical beliefs, and they...
That's what got him killed.
Yeah, that's what got him killed. And it turns out he was at least two-thirds right. The one-third that we don't know about yet, actually, is, you know, are these other planets all inhabited?
Why was knowledge heresy in those days?
We have a worldview that... I just think it's remarkable that we live in times now where you can question all sorts of things.
Yeah, but you don't kill them.
Yeah, you don't kill them for what they believe. I think in Bruno's case, he was killed in part for these espousing these heretical philosophies of life being everywhere. Part of it was, if life is everywhere, where's heaven then? And where's hell? You know, if life is all over the place, it sort of diminishes the importance of the Earth. And so for those of us who think that life on Earth is special and singular and was created by God and put here at the Garden of Eden, and then we've, moved around the planet, if you think that's happened all over the universe, it makes it a little harder to think that you're special.
Eric, I knew the late Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, and he was such a staunch believer that we have been visited.
Mm-hmm.
He used to tell me, he said, I've never seen anything, George. I didn't see anything when I walked on the moon, but I've been told by people within government that we are being visited. That's an amazing story.
I think it's an important story because a lot of this data is just coming out. I think that the data that's been being recorded, these aircraft that are flying around, they now have the radars and imagers and infrared sensors that would be comparable to what was on a whole airfield back in the 70s.
That's right.
Single airplane. And so the stuff that...
Well, we've got more computer power in our smartphone than they had on the Apollo 11 mission.
Absolutely. And the telescopes that are looking at things are seeing things that we never dreamed of seeing before. And it's a story that keeps going, because the more we advance our society, the more we build the technologies to make mirrors that are 8 meters diameter and, giant telescopes that you launch into space. We're headed in this direction where they call it, the skeptics of UFOs talk about the low information zone. I don't know if you've heard that phrase before, but it's, at the fringes of what you can observe. You don't quite have certain knowledge, and so you put together things in your head that make sense to you. And so sometimes people would say, hey, it's just that you're unable to see it in any other way, so you're seeing it as alien visitations or something. I actually think that a lot of the folks who have seen these things are incredibly serious people, including a number of these fighter jet pilots.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
And that they don't have any benefit to coming out with this.
No, there's no monetary gain here or anything like that.
No, so I'm actually extremely interested in this kind of stuff.
Let's go to Thomas in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Okay, all well.
Cool. I have a theory that partially coincides with your first callers.
All right.
What if the moon collided with the Earth at the 23.5 three axis tilt? I'd heard there was a belt of moon rocks at that same declension. And if it was quite possibly sent from the Orions, series of Pleiadians, which is connected through the soul shafts in the pyramid of Cheops, to destroy the Earth as it had been Mars before then, because Mars, as the world found out, has a sphinx and a pyramid been photographed on it.
Well, he's talking about the fact that maybe the moon was towed into place, like so many people think. What do you think there, skeptic?
It's a lot. It takes a lot of work. It's a very big, massive object. When you go into there's this thing, Occam's razor, right? You know, what's the most simple explanation?
Is always the one.
It's often the one, and we have a pretty good idea of how the moon would have formed in a giant impact. Briefly, the moon is, prior to the Apollo missions, we didn't know what to expect, actually, and the Ranger missions that crashed into the moon. We started to see that the moon wasn't some primitive object. It's actually mostly volcanic. And the question, and then we also knew that the moon is underdense, which means it doesn't have a big iron core. So how do you make a planet? So apart from how did the moon get to be where it was, the big scientific question was, how do you make a planet that's that weird? It doesn't have an iron core. It's melted entirely. It doesn't have any water. It doesn't have any atmosphere. And you start to develop theories, and you test them out, and you try them. And people did try capture hypotheses, but the moon is a big beast to try to capture around the Earth, even without thinking about some other aliens towing it into place. Just trying to make it capture into orbit around the Earth by a physical process, it turns out you actually have to collide into the Earth to get it to stop. So it's one of those things where, kind of like trying to grab a moving car that's moving by you at 80 miles an hour. You got to catch up to speed with it first. There's just basic laws of physics that apply.
Eric, how long did you work on this book?
It took about 2 years, probably a half a year to write the first draft, where I had originally tried to write it as a bunch of vignettes, because it's sort of, every topic is complicated once you go down that path far enough. And I had sort of originally written it to be starting out simple, and then when things get too burdensome scientifically, start a different topic. My publisher wanted it to be a little bit more in a classical structure with chapters, and so we shuffled all that together into more of these seven different stories that tell kind of a different tale. I'd say the whole process took about 2 years, and in the process of writing it, I learned so much. So even if I never sold a single copy of the book, I'd be really happy that I wrote it.
Well, you'll sell more than one, that's for sure, Eric. Thank you so much for being on the program. Let's not let 8 years go by for your next appearance. Up next, Miracles on Coast to Coast AM.